Morning, everybody. I'm here to talk to you and hopefully have a two-way discussion. If you guys can just shout out at any point, talk about where we see the economy going, mostly going to focus on the U.S. economy, but we're going to have some comments and discussion on important international trends. We're going to focus fairly heavily on the housing market. I know that's an important end use driver for a lot of you, but even for those of you for whom it's not a hugely important driver, it is a huge piece of the puzzle as to where the economy is going. It's really the weak housing quote unquote recovery that we've had the last 10 years is really the main reason why we've had such a kind of lackluster overall economic growth. And finally, I'm going to end on a topic of interest, and that's something that's kind of near and dear to our heart as we looked at a bunch of mega trends in the industry. It's how we see the U.S. construction sector changing in fundamental ways over the next 2 to 3 to 5 to 20 years. Without further ado, I'm just going to get started, and I want to thank you all for pulling me out of the frozen north. My yard still has a whole bunch of snow in it, so it's really been beautiful down here. So thanks for that. And we're going to start with some comments on the U.S. macroeconomy. Okay, this is a great slide that kind of gives a pulse of the U.S. economy at any given time. It's the Small Business Indicators Index, a Small Business Confidence Index, excuse me. And as you can see, it really surged in December of 16, following the last presidential election. And it's been elevated since, kind of it's been consistent with strong economic growth. And you see a decline over the last few months. It's stabilized more recently, but there's a clear weakening. That peak up there in last August was a 45-year high. So we've weakened. But we've weakened to a reasonable level of growth. But having said that, there's a fair amount of folks out there who have a recession call for 2019. Gary Shiller, who famously called the last housing bust, he's probably the most prominent example. And it's clear, based on what the Fed did the other day and some of their Fed communications, that they're worried. So I kind of want, that's the first question I want to try to examine is, are we going to have recession soon? Not to spoil it, but my call is that no, we're not going to have a recession, and I'll go through it. But a couple slides make me worry that I'm going to show you. So for starters, how do we get a recession typically? In a typical case, you're getting late in the economic cycle, you start to get inflationary pressures, and the Fed starts raising interest rates. That's what they call their short-term instrument, the federal funds rate. They raise it, and you can see these gray bars, I don't know why you can see, but the light gray bars are recessions. And you can see that pretty much before every recession, you get a rise in short-term interest rates. And lo and behold, we've had that. But a couple things to note. One, the Fed just announced they're not going to raise anymore. So in December, they raised rates, kind of probably shouldn't have, and they said, we're going to raise rates 2 more times next year and probably 2 more times a year after that. Well, now they're saying, we're not committed to raise rates, and we could lower rates next. Okay? Where we get concerned is this indicator called the yield curve, which has been a very, very good indicator of recession. So a lot of people look at the stock market, and there's a famous expression that says the stock market's predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions. Okay, so that's what we were saying back in December. Stocks kind of were weak. Well, the yield curve is a lot better track record. The yield curve is the difference between the 10-year bond yield and the 3-month treasury. That 3-month treasury is pretty much controlled by the Fed. It really tracks closely to that Fed funds rate. The long-term rate is a different story. That's market-driven totally. And the thing that drives it, there's really two things that drive it. One, inflation expectations. So if the Fed, if bondholders think inflation is going to be low, then that yield is going to come down. The other is growth expectations. They think economic growth is going to be weak, and often, but not always, and not recently, economic growth and inflation go hand in hand. So you get strong, weak economic growth usually goes hand in hand with low inflation pressures. But that relationship's broken down a little bit. So this is the cause for concern. You can see, now, we've had some false positives when that yield curve goes down, but when it actually goes negative and inverts, we get a recession. And prior to the 1990-91 recession, it didn't even quite invert. So if you're making a recession call, this is the number one chart you're going to show. Okay? And the inflation expectations by the bond market kind of back that up. And it kind of explains why the Fed has said, whoa, we're not going to raise rates. I mean, the Fed has two jobs, price stability, which means no inflation, or keeping inflation below 2%, and full employment, which we're at right now. So the Fed sells these bonds that are called Treasury Inflation Protected Bonds so that you get a yield after subtracting off the inflation rate, okay? Well, they also have a nominal bond. You take the difference, do a couple other calculations, and you can determine what bond market investors think inflation is going to be over the next 10 years. And in March, it fell to 1.72%. So it's really no wonder that that the Fed is kind of put a halt on things. Okay. I was talking to Bob on a phone call prior to this, and he suggested he really wanted to hear our thoughts on the deficit. Well, there's a lot of interesting talk about how the U.S. budget deficit should evolve over the next few years. If we think that if the deficit's going to be a problem, the way it's going to really manifest itself is in inflation expectations, okay? So let's say a government just jacks up the debt. Well, there's an incentive to use inflation to erode the value of that debt. Okay, and we can see from this chart that bondholders aren't worried. Okay, other folks who aren't worried are some of these politicians and economists who are talking about something called MMT, Modern Monetary Theory. So their theory is, deficits don't matter. You can run up the deficit. As long as the interest rate is lower than the economic growth rate, and it has been the last couple of years, you're fine. These are a lot of the same eggheads that brought us the last housing crisis. So I would say the debt is important. There is scope to increase it near term. But one, is there a spending problem or a tax problem, right? I mean, I would say this is more of a spending problem. The folks propounding MMT would say, there's a tax problem. We're not raising enough taxes. I would disagree with that. So having said that, for the near term anyway, it's pretty clear that bond markets aren't worried about inflation, and there is scope to run these deficits. So these are the projections put out by the Congressional Budget Office. That they're kind of like the neutral party that most people kind of agree is a fair assessment of what's going to happen over the next several years. You can see we have huge deficits following the Great Recession. That makes sense. It doesn't make sense to run deficits when the unemployment rate is under 4%. And then, if you're gonna increase government spending, it doesn't make sense to increase it for things like entitlements. You want to increase it for things that raise the productivity growth rate. So, another important indicator of recession is oil prices. It's been a very good indicator. If we look at inflation-adjusted oil prices here, in five of the last six recessions, oil prices spike. And usually, prior to the last 5 years or so, rising oil prices are bad for the U.S. economy. It would really whack consumer spending, right? Gas prices would go up. Home heating prices would go up. Spending would go down. At this point, it's about a wash, because you do get that suppressed effect on consumption. But we've seen, because of the revolution in fracking technology and then a huge expansion in U.S. oil capacity, that investment tends to increase when oil prices go up. Okay, so and oil prices aren't likely to go up very high. This forecast is from the International Energy, the Department of Energy, and the reason it's not going to go up mostly is because global demand's kind of flattening out, and because the U.S. is producing a huge amount of oil. The U.S. is now exporting oil. The U.S. is now the biggest oil producer in the world. So rising oil prices isn't a huge concern. And finally, housing. Housing has almost always led the U.S. into recession and led it out. Why? Well, housing is very interest rate sensitive. So we're late cycle, you get a rise in interest rates, mortgage rates go up, people stop lending. This isn't a typical situation. But we're not in a typical situation. Because we've never really had a housing recovery from the crash. And I'm going to get into a lot more detail on this in a bit. But you know, you can see it's been a pretty good indicator. If we look at new home inventories, if they start to build up, they kind of peaked late last year and they've come down. We expect that they're going to continue to come down. My colleague is down at a Timberland conference down in Amelia Island in Florida, and they have a gentleman there from the Architectural Association. His name is escaping me, Kermit Baker. He thinks that housing's peaked for the cycle. We differ with that view, and I'll go through why. We don't think housing's peaked. We have a flat year this year, then gradual increase for a whole bunch of reasons that I'll get into. So economic growth is going to fall, but from a very high level. So it's the second half of last year is 3.5% on a year-over-year basis. Real GDP is up 3.1%. That's the highest rate in 5 years or so, 4 or 5 years. And we have a very tight labor market. And the tight labor market is a blessing. It can be a curse for folks trying to hire, but it can have a lot of positive effects. And the last time we had a labor market like this was the late 90s. Okay? So what this chart, so we know the unemployment rate is under 4%, it's 3.8%. Initial claims for unemployment insurance are at a generational low. As you all know, it's very hard to find workers. This chart shows the number of unemployed people per job opening. You can see we're at a record low since this series started. So it's there are more job openings than there are unemployed people to fill. The thing about unemployed people, though, unemployment and how they're measured is you have to be looking for a job to be counted as unemployed. So what a tight labor market does, it kind of tends to increase wages, but it pulls people off the sidelines, increases your labor. So if we think about economic growth, it's two things. It's increasing your labor force plus the amount of output per worker. That's it, right? That's productivity. Another thing that a tight labor market does is it forces firms to use labor more judiciously, right? It's hard to get people. Like, let's not waste them. Or it forces firms to buy labor-saving equipment. So that increases productivity growth, increases investment. So you get what they call a virtuous cycle associated with low unemployment. There's a theory out there called the Phillips curve, which says that when unemployment gets low, wages go up. And we've kind of had rising wages over the last couple of years, but there's still nothing to write home about. So this one on the right is a great measure. It tracks employment costs, and it's up about 3%, but it's kind of lower than where it was earlier in the 2000s. Average hourly earnings, this green line over here, it's trending up. The Atlanta Fed wage tracker, which only tracks folks who have been in a job for over a year, it's going up, but we still have fairly disappointing wage growth, but the good news is it's been rising, and the thing that's going to bring it up is productivity growth. I think this is a great chart. Going all the way back to 1952, it shows compensation per hour versus productivity plus inflation. So you can see that tight relationship. And it's not clear which causes what. I mean, mostly, if I want to know what's going to happen with wages, I'm more interested in what's going on with productivity, really, than what's going on with the unemployment rate. But this is the key chart to look for. So when we want to try to figure out how fast the economy is going to grow going forward, Trump administration is looking at a 3 to 3.5% range. A lot of mainstream economists are saying that's not going to happen because you need labor force growth, productivity growth. You add those two up and you get your GDP growth. And because of our aging of our population, labor force growth is growing, but not as fast as it used to. Productivity is kind of a black box. That's been down. So the only way you're going to get up into that range there is if we get a pretty sharp increase in productivity. So that's like a key thing that people should be looking at. From kind of a near-term perspective, we're going to see economic growth kind of fall to 2-2.5%. I think we have 2.2% for 19, okay, from 2.9% last year, and then go up and exceed. We expect the Congressional Budget Office that produces an economic forecast, and that's their forecast, the blue line of trend growth rate. And we think we're going to exceed trend growth rate for the next couple of years because of that virtuous cycle associated with the tight labor market that I discussed. So are we going to have gangbusters growth? No. Are we going to have great growth this year? No. We're going to have about 2% growth. But it's not going to be a recession. Okay, but there are some other trends in the economy beyond just GDP growth that folks need to look at. And that's who's getting the growth. So if we look at average growth, that's you take all the people out there and you take all the output and you can look at per capita growth. But what's important to look at is the median household income. So the median household income is that income level of which half U.S. households earn more and half earn less. Okay, and that's been very weak, that growth, up until the last few years. And it started to take off. So we've had a lot of growth. We've had a lot of the economic growth going to folks at the top 2-3%. Okay, and the people in the middle has been stagnant. But these are people buying homes and furniture and so forth. Okay, but that's starting to change. And the thing that changes that more than any government policy is a tight labor market. So we've had a 12% increase through 17. We have more recent data from Sentier Research Institute that really is current. Comes out on a monthly basis. It's current as of, I think, January. And over the last 2 years, your median household growth, income growth, has been 3%. It's been twice as fast as your average. Okay? So that says we're finally starting to see income growth going to folks in the lower part of the income scale, and this is hugely important. Hugely important, because these are the people who are going to buy the products that are made from wood, softwood, hardwood, both. Okay? Let's just take a look at in 2017, kind of that income distribution, right? But only about 30% of households earn $100,000, okay? And when I get into housing, we're going to talk about that. So I said, okay, let's just assume a household makes $100,000. Well, if I go to the Zillow calculator and say, how much mortgage can I afford? How much of a house can I afford? And I assume a modest down payment, a modest used car payment, a modest insurance premium payment. Very conservative assumptions. Lo and behold, I get that a household that earns $100,000 can afford a house that's $283,000. And the average new home, or the median new home price, is about $325,000 to $330,000. So builders are not building homes that folks can afford. So that, I mean, that's the bottom line. And we're starting to see evidence that that's changing, okay? But there needs to be something. Now, I'm going to get into affordability a little bit later, but this is a huge issue. Again, and the cure takes a while, and it's a tight labor market. Another pressing issue, I think, is health costs. If you look at any measure of entrepreneurship, it's way down over the last 25 years, okay? Is that because millennials are wimps? Maybe. I think they are. But this is a huge issue. This thwarts entrepreneurship. So we're at the point now where the average family plan is coming up on $20,000, and the employee share keeps rising and rising. So we go back to 2000. The average employee contribution consumed 3.9% of household median household income. Flash forward to the current times, the average employee contribution is almost 10%. Of household income. So it's suppressing growth, and it's very expensive for entrepreneurs to go out, start a business when they have this cost right away. Student loans are another huge problem. So student loan debt has doubled over the last 10 years. Okay? So it used to be 4.7% of all debt, now it's 10.9%. So, and it's more than doubled in dollar terms. So, huge issue, kind of slowing the household formation, keeping people living with their parents for longer. This is going to be a big issue, I think, in the 2020 election campaign. Okay, let's talk about manufacturing a little bit. Kind of near-term trends. Industrial production was really strong last year. It was up about 4%. We think it's going to come down about 2.5% for this year, and maybe a little bit more for the following year. More near-term basis, if we look at the ISM, Institute of Supply Management Manufacturing Index, we're down, but we're still above. We're down over the last several months for both the new orders and the total index. Again, still above. We're down from a very, very high level or a very solid level. But, you know, we advise you to watch that trend closely. You know, part of the issue is exports, right? Export growth has fallen off. Why? China's slowing down. Europe's slowing down. Japan's slowing down. And Canada's slowing down. Okay, so you have that. We have a dollar that was, as of a couple weeks ago, is up 7% on a year-over-year basis. And we look at the ratio of export prices to import prices. U.S. exports are more expensive, imports are cheaper. So this is a concern. So is the dollar is going to weaken a little bit relative to what we thought because of the change in the Fed stance, but not much. The dollar is likely to remain strong because it's kind of the tallest jockey in town because of the weakness in the other countries that don't manage their currency, and then China manages their currency. So they're not going to let their currency weaken appreciably versus the dollar over the next few years. Kind of the good news from a U.S. domestic economy standpoint is the trade is much smaller portion of our economy than most people think, and it's a much smaller portion of our economy than most of the other major economies, pretty much all the other major economies. So this is just exports as a percent of GDP, we're at about 12%. I mean, you look at the euro area, a lot of that's interregional, but it's still higher. It's way up. But if you look at Canada, 30%, China, 20%, even India is higher. So if you're exporting, that's not great news, but if you're really concerned with the U.S. domestic economy and the ability of, say, if these trade talks go south with China, will that tip us into recession? I don't think so. Kind of talk about some international issues. North America is unique among the major regions. If we look at working age population, so we'll call that 15 to 64. We look back, if we look, compare the past to a point, we'll set the current point at 2015 because it's where the data is. I got this data from the UN. North America is the only place where the working age population is projected to grow. Okay? And you look at China coming way down. Japan's been falling for a number of years. Europe's coming down. So from a longer term perspective, in terms of output growth, remember, labor force growth and productivity, what comprise economic growth, the U.S. and Canada are well positioned relative to the other advanced economies or major economies out there. Okay, which brings me to some talk in China. So China's just slowing down a little bit, and if you believe this graph, I have some land to sell you. This is from the IMF. They're growing at about 6.5%. I know where China's going to grow. I can tell you what their growth rate is going to be because, and I'm going to be right within a couple decimal points, because GDP growth in China is determined by the government. The constraint on GDP growth in China is a lending constraint. So the way it works is the party sets a target, and then the local governments go out and borrow until they can meet that target. So it's no wonder why you get consistent, very flat growth. But interestingly, if we look at some other data, car sales are down 14%, consumption tax revenue is down 14%, cell phones last year, mobile phone sales were down 15.5%. So we know there's a professor at Texas A&M named Gan Li, does a lot of research in China. He estimates there are 50 million empty housing units in China and that the vacancy rate is 22%. So that doesn't sound like an economy that's growing at 6%. So China has not had an official recession since the late 80s. That's a long time. They probably flirted. One influential economist in China estimated that economic growth was under 2% last year, not the 6.5% that they said. So God knows where he is now. And what's interesting is if we look at China's debt loads, okay, this is total debt to GDP. A couple things jump out at you. One, yeah, the U.S. is the blue line. It's a drag, but it went up. It's come down, stabilized. This is as a percent of income. China, that exploded in 2008-09, right? So you have the global financial crisis. The whole world goes in the tank, and China needs to continue to grow. Their export markets dry up. They ramp up the debt. And it's kind of stabilized at a high level. What's also scary is over the last few years, China's GDP has been overestimated by 15 to 30%, okay, depending on who you believe. So it's actually that debt as a percent of GDP has continued to rise. Another interesting thing about this chart is you look at Japan, right? And Japan starts, their economy starts hitting the skids right around 94, 95. And the debt, you know. So at one time, the grounds around the Imperial Palace in Tokyo were said to be worth as much as all the real estate in California. That's a bubble. So, and it's come down, and you see China. So going forward, can China continue to expand the debt? Eventually, you get what economists call a Minsky moment. That's when the debt kind of collapses on itself. People can't pay. You get mass bankruptcies. Now, the government has huge foreign reserves. If they start getting a bank problems, they can just nationalize the debt. But there still needs to be a way to pay back that growth, and there still needs to be productive investments. And what China has seen, so much of its growth driven by investment, but every dollar or yuan of extra investment every year yields less and less and less GDP because it's not productive investment. So this China debt story is a huge concern if I were exporting to China. Longer term, this chart blows me away. This just compares China and Japan. Okay, so let's look at the red is China's working age population. The black is Japan's working age population, but set back 20 years. Let's look at the black. So you go up, 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 up. 70s, 80s, Japan's growing gangbusters. It peaks right around, you know, early 90s, 94, 93. And since then, Japan's population, its working age population started to come down. Now it's overall population. You track that with China's. This is projections using the U.S. UN population series, and it's pretty remarkable, the overlay. So longer term, another thing to be concerned with China. I stole this from Charles Schwab. It's great. I love this chart. So what area is going to grow in terms of working age population? This one kind of blew me away when I looked at it. It's North Africa and North Africa and West Asia, which is Middle East, basically. So I know Europeans are shipping a ton of lumber into those regions, and they're pretty excited about the prospect going forward. So even on this is just absolute number of people. It's not a growth rate. You can look at, you know, Europe is over the next 15 years, the population is going to come down 28 million. And then in China, it's so huge, right? But growth rates have come way down, and birth rates plummeted. China went from one-child policy to a two-child policy, and the Chinese promptly reacted by having even fewer babies. It's plummeted to its lowest level since 1962, which was right near the end of the Great Famine. Okay? So, on a forward-looking basis, North Africa and West Asia look pretty interesting in terms of economic growth. In terms of furniture, I got this slide from my colleague Greg Lewis. Greg is our wood panels economist. Couple take-home points. So this is U.S. wood furniture inputs. Imports, right? So you can see that the import share of and you guys know this story, it was about 35% back in 2000, and you know it's risen to up over 80%. So where are they coming from? You can see this over here. It's a combination of China and Vietnam, really the main ones, and other Asia, which is mostly Malaysia and Indonesia. Okay? But you can see the increasing importance of Vietnam relative to China. So, all right. Good point of time. Housing overview. Okay. So, we've been under building. Stands the reason that we're going to continue to rise, and I've been getting up here and talking about long-term housing boom that we have, and it kind of reminds me of my heritage a little bit. I saw this tweet, said brilliant Irish text message. Brilliant Irish is kind of redundant, so I took that out. And it said, you know, Miriam had one more pint with the lads. If I'm not home in 20 minutes, read this message again. So I'm going to say that to you. If I'm wrong about this, I'll come back next year and read it again. So we've had increasing housing completions each of the last 7 years. Isn't that great? It's all relative, right? So where we are, where we were in last year in terms of homes being completed, is pretty much typical of previous recessions. This data goes back to 1968. So we climbed the mountain to get to the point which was a previous valley. So this is one of the reasons why I don't think housing's peaked. We're not building enough houses to feed a growing population. The population grows every year. It used to grow 2.5 to 3 million. Now it's still 2 million to 2.5 million every year. Okay? And we're not producing enough housing to house these people. Near term, things took a turn for the worse. Our favorite, late last year, our favorite indicator is new home sales. We can do a couple calculations, make a few assumptions. We map that to housing starts and we compare it to the trend. So we had a long bottom following the recession, and we're still below that. We really keep looking at that post-2011 trend. In the last 3 months, new home sales have mapped to only about 1.19 million starts. And to make our forecast for this year true, we're forecasting roughly flat housing starts from 18 to 19. We need to get sales up to almost 660,000. So from the 610 that we averaged in the last 6 months, and we've averaged a little higher over the last three. We don't know that we're going to make it. So our housing forecast, yes, we expect housing starts to go up after kind of they've come down. We expect them kind of weak first quarter, then resume that weak uptrend. But we're not even going to get to the kind of wimpy, August should be December, but that wimpy trend post 2011. So why? I mean, we're obviously don't have enough housing, and the economy's strong, relatively strong. Unemployment rate's low. What's going on? Well, we're labor constrained. Okay, and this is something I'm going to talk about later. So let's look at the red line here is the total employment in residential construction. You can see we're about 20% below where we were at the previous peak, and we're building a lot fewer houses. Yet the unemployment rate is below where it was. So it's all-time low. The unemployment rate for workers in residential construction. So we don't have a ton of these folks on the sideline. And I don't think we're going to get many more immigrants from Mexico based on, based not really on policy. That's a secondary thing. Based on the fact that the Mexican birth rate plunged in the 90s. And that there simply aren't enough folks to come over. Even if we open the border and say, come on, build houses, they're not there. So we need to think about new ways to approach this, and I'm going to talk about that. So we look at the Associated General Contractors of America survey. We look at a whole range of occupations, and these are the percentages of position types that general contractors have a tough time filling. It rose from 17 to 18 and high. I mean, 67% of these guys can't find carpenters. Well, another reason is home prices are up, right? Price goes up, you think people buy less, right? So if we look at the long-term trend for housing, we're above that. We've had strong home price growth the last few years, kind of come off a little bit. And that's dented affordability. The home price relative to rent, median home price rather than median rent, that surge, that's a good indicator. That's saying that, wow, houses are pretty expensive. See how expensive they were during the bubble. Well, not there, but that last spike's pretty concerning. And this is a index of affordability. Higher is better. Okay? Affordability is coming down. Right? Because mortgage rates have been coming up a little bit, even though they rose last year. They've since been coming down, but they're still a little bit higher than they were a year ago. And affordability is coming down. Even if we make some pessimistic assumption, affordability isn't so bad, and it's really concentrated in a few areas. So if you look at price-to-income ratios, Most people, most houses are affordable, particularly in the upper Midwest, in the South. The problem is the orange and yellow areas, particularly California. California is a disaster in terms of affordability. They're creating jobs, but they're not building homes. So that's just bidding up the prices of the current homes that are there. So when people always ask me, oh my God, there's such an affordability problem, I'll say, where do you live? I mean, you could argue that houses are too cheap in the upper Midwest. Okay, and this kind of shows the scale of California's woes. This is housing permits per 1,000 people. See, the U.S. came way down. We've barely recovered. It's terrible. But then you look at California. You look at California, and it's just been flat, despite very strong job growth. So I'm going to show you a house that just sold a little less than a year ago, for almost $1 million in San Jose. There it is. I mean, well, that's the yard. That's kind of nice. That's what $938,000 will get you. Now I'm going to show you a home I look for. What's a fancy suburb of Houston, right? Sugarland, right? This house is cheaper. Okay, so is housing affordable? Where do you live? Is housing affordable? Where do you live in terms of around the world? Let's look at the other major English-speaking countries. In Canada, I like to say that. Hopefully there's no Canadians here. Hopefully there are Canadians here. So we look at real home prices. That's inflation adjusted. You look at the blue line in the U.S. Yeah, they're up. They're slightly below the peak before. But look at Australia. Look at the United Kingdom. Look at the USA. But what's interesting is all of those countries are building homes at a rate that's much closer to their long-term average than we are in the States. We're not building. There is no supply response here. There is there, more so. This chart shows price to income. It's another measure of how expensive houses are. Again, U.S. is the outlier. Okay, so if you think houses are expensive in the U.S., I don't recommend moving to some of these other places. Okay, which gets us to our forecast for housing starts. And we do a bottom-up demographic analysis of underlying demand. And if you go from World War II even to 1995, that line above the curve, you look at the red line versus the green line, underlying demand, the area over the line and the area under the line tend to add up. You know, you get a period where you overbuild, then underbuild, overbuild, underbuild. By the time we get to the bubble in 06, we're overbuilt by about 2 million homes in the U.S. But what's remarkable about this chart is how much we've underbuilt since. Okay, we make some pretty conservative estimates to get to that green line, too. You look at that on a cumulative basis, you see overbuilt, and then we're underbuilt to the tune of 4 million homes relative to the population. So that's that's one of the main take-home points for this presentation. And to kind of build our optimistic long-term story, it's hard not to be optimistic. This chart does more than any other. We look at the peak age group. This is as of the middle of this year. Two biggest age groups, 28-year-olds and 29-year-olds. 4.6 million, roughly, of each. Okay, they're coming in into the pipeline. As they come into the early 30s, you should expect to see more household formation. And you should expect this to be a pretty strong tailwind. You can see this is headship rates, a propensity to form a new household, right? It really jumps as you leave your 20s, going to your 30s and late 30s. Now, there's evidence to support the idea that this is going to happen more in the late 30s. Typically, it used to be the early 30s. Right now, the median first-time home buyer is about 32, right? That could go up. One of the main triggers for buying a single-family home, and that's going to consume more of your products, one of the main things is birth of a first child. And you can see, if you look at percent of childless women, it's rising for the younger women in their early 30s, but it's actually come down a little bit for women in their late 30s. That says that women are pushing off, women are pushing off the birth of the first child, which is a key trigger for the household formation. Another thing that's going to kind of moderate this is the rise in intergenerational living. So we've seen that, and that's due to economic hardship, but also the change in our demographic mix. The white people tend to have low rates relative to pretty much, Hispanics, Asians, African Americans, all have much higher rates of intergenerational living, even adjusting for income, even high income folks. So this is a kind of a change in the mix going forward. So our housing long shot is kind of flat this year and then grinding up that curve over the next several years. And by 21, 22, we expect some of these long-term tailwinds to really kick in, demographic tailwinds. Another thing that's kind of shifting the R&R a little bit and new homes is the average age of a house. The median owner-occupied house in the United States was built in 1977. It's 40 years old. Okay, 54% of U.S. owner-occupied homes were built before 1980, and only less than 5% were built since 2010. So our house is old. And so that should benefit R&R and new construction. Another thing that's going to benefit R&R is the surge in home equity. Home equity since late 2011 is up 144%. We're about 27-28% above the long-term trend. Why is that important? Well, the old HELOC loan, right? That's how a lot of folks, that's how they finance their improvements on their house, okay? And so without the HE in HELOC is home equity, home equity line of credit. So we're starting to see the wherewithal. You can see why it was so weak, 08, 09, 10, 11, home equity evaporated. So this rapid increase in prices should have definitely provided tailwind to R&R spending, which, as many of you know who follow this, the data for R&R is a little tricky. We use data from the C30 report from the census, and you can see it came way down. You get a surge in 2005 or so with all these cash-out refi mortgages, and now you've seen very strong growth over the last couple of years. And we expect it to remain above trend. Why? Strong home equity, but more importantly, old homes. Okay, so I want to get into something. I find it interesting. We're running a conference in Boston. We ran it last year on the kind of the future of home construction. And it will have potential effects for the folks in this room, even if you're not, doing dimension lumber or whatever. So I've talked about there's a shortage of construction workers. It's clear. It's all over the place. It's anecdotal. It's in the data. There's another thing going on. It's the productivity in the construction sector is terrible. So if we look at U.S. industry overall, up since 1995, we're up about 30% in terms of productivity, output per hour. We're down by about 20%. So we're 20% less productive now than we were in 1995 when it comes to construction. Okay, something needs to change, like this guy, right? Does he want to be seen or not? So my colleague, Rocky Goodnow, said, he's from Southwest Virginia. He said, well, I think you're against a lot of guys dressed like that, when they're out hunting. I pointed out he's at a subway station. So I don't think he's taking the train to his deer stand, but something needs to change. And that is we need to get productivity growing in the construction sector. So since World War II, like I think 1947, productivity's up 6%. In housing. And we build houses basically the same way. The major innovation has been the nail gun. And then you compare that to retail, it's up almost 700%. Manufacturing's up 760%. and agriculture is up 1,500%. So clearly, it's lagging. So if we look at productivity versus productivity growth, you want to be in that northeast corner. The real laggards are down here in the southwest. Look where framing is. Very unproductive. Single-family housing, very unproductive. You're in the dead zone. Multifamily housing, a little better. You get some economies of scale, but still. And then automobile manufacturing. Manufacturing in general is excellent. Automobile is really high. And why is that? It's because we don't build cars in our driveways. So there's all sorts of reasons why we need to think about building off-site, building in a factory environment. And this will have effects for how furnishing is done, depending on which methods are selected. So among the reasons are you don't have to worry about weather. You double the size of your labor force, essentially, because more women, it's much easier to attract women. There's much less of a premium on strength. It's a much safer environment. It's more efficient. And one of the you have economies of scale. There's less waste. It will change the supply chain. That's one of the things I thought. One of the reasons why I thought this would be interesting to you is it could fundamentally change the supply chain if we start supplying to off-site manufacturers instead of on-site. Every house is a snowflake or custom homes. Okay, it doesn't really make sense. And one of the things that's enabling this is something called BIM, Business Information Management Software. The software is really enabling us to do this. Sears used to build houses in the 20s, in fact, and ship them out to people. So in certain respects, this isn't new. But now we have the necessity to do it, and the capabilities enhanced because of the software. Okay? So a lot of this is showing up in the form of CLT, right, or mass panels. CLT is cross-laminated timbers. Huge panels, some of which can be up to 20 meters by 6 meters, okay? And these houses go up quick. If we look at Brock Commons in Canada, this is an 18-story dorm built of wood. Everything but the elevator shafts are wood, and that went up in 9 weeks. And it was able to be built twice before it was built because of the software. Marriott's doing is very, very interesting. Marriott's building modular. They're using modular homes to build hotels. Okay, so they stack these boxes, and within that's a furnished box. That has the television, the carpeting, all the furnishing in there. So this changes, certainly changes the supply chain for those things. Okay, and if you look, you hardly know. And Marriott loves this. Now, does it cost less? Not really. Most of the analysis thus far said it costs about the same. But the time to occupancy is cut in half, 50%. So this is very, very attractive to developers because they can free up that money much more quickly. Marriott's doing it. Hilton's doing it. We had a guy from Marriott speak at this conference last year. Hilton's doing it. This is going to be a game changer, we think. And we think wood is the material of the future. You have wood. What are your building materials out there? You get wood, you get steel, you get concrete. In terms of green credentials, wood is by far, it's renewable, it's by far the best. Concrete is very problematic from a green perspective, as is steel, especially steel coming from China. So, stick framing. To stick frame a house, this even is going to single family. There's a company called Integra that was just bought by LP. They go from 71 man days down to 14 man days. Huge productivity increase. And I'm going to end on this little video. You can see just how quickly this happens. Are you going to? Oh, I guess I'm not. Could you play the video, please? Or not. So I just wanted to introduce I wanted to introduce the notion that construction is most likely to change dramatically over the next 20 years. We think it's going to be off-site. We think wood's going to play a huge role. Both, there is hardwood being used in a lot of those CLT panels. Inside the panel, there's hardwood and softwood. I know Sterling is the biggest CLT producer in the country. They're doing that. So this is something that we would urge you all to kind of pay attention to, and its effects on the supply chain. It's not going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years. It's happening slowly, but it's happening. And those two mega trends are there: shortage of labor, horrible productivity, and growing population. Something needs to change. So, okay, I think I went the full hour. Does anyone have questions? All right, well, I have to, I won't be around. Yes, Amanda says she's going to send that out to you next week. And if you have questions, my contact information is on the back. Just reach out to me. So. Great. All right, well, thank you very much.